Aloha, this is Catherine Cruz. Mahalo for joining us here on The Conversation, Hawaii Talks. It is Monday, June 16th. We are just coming off parades and protests following a tumultuous week of political violence. We hear community voices from a No King's Day of Defiance rally. Facing our future, ours to find or lose, we ponder how to build Hawaii's economy and reverse a troubling trajectory. We hear about efforts throughout French Polynesia to raise awareness about France's nuclear history in the region. And we sit down with Eddie Flores to talk about his new book, Franchising the American Dream, the story behind L&L Drive-In, now rebranded as L&L Hawaiian Barbecue. Is The Conversation on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. The weekend began with a parade of tanks and troops and ended with fireworks. And while that was playing out in our nation's capital, here in the islands, thousands across the state gathered in a day of defiance. The protests were billed as a No King's Day held across the nation. In Washington, D.C., military might was in the spotlight as the parade marking the 250th anniversary of the U.S. Army got underway. President Donald Trump spoke for 8 minutes on Saturday. It also marked his 79th birthday.
Every other country celebrates their victories. It's about time. America did too. That's what we're doing tonight.
Back here in the islands, thousands across the state gathered to take part in the No King's Day of Defiance. On the Big Island, several demonstrators wore red and white robes, a reference to The Handmaid's Tale. At the state capitol on Oahu, law enforcement officers estimated a crowd of close to 5,000 lined the streets that stretched past Punch Bowl to Alakea. Sergio Alcubilla is the director for community engagement at the ACLU of Hawaii. He says organizers expected some 7,000 statewide.
The rhetoric is really changing around what this country is all about, what it, you know, should be, what it could be. And I think our fear is that this administration is taking us in a direction that we don't want to go. And I think that's what this rally is important for, that people are showing up and saying, no, that's not the America that we think of. That's not the America that we imagine for our kids. And this today is supposed to be No King's Day, right? In conjunction with what President Trump is doing, having the military parade together with his birthday, right? It sends the wrong signal, I think, to people, politicizing our military, of using local law enforcement to enforce immigration. I mean, that's not what America is all about.
Alcubilla said that the ACLU is ramping up its legal efforts around immigration, including hiring an attorney to focus in the area. Many who turned out pointed to immigration as a key issue. Corey Asano showed up on behalf of Local 5, which represents 10,000 hospitality, healthcare, and food service workers in Hawaii.
Well, I think this is an important moment in history where there's a lot of injustice going on, and it's a great opportunity where a mass amount of people that may not have the same interests all the time, like this is one common thing I think everyone can agree on, our civil rights, justice for all. I'm from Local 5. The Hotel Workers Union, so of course we want to set up for immigrant workers all over the place, and just kind of seeing what's to come from the things that are going on in LA, that this is just a moment that we all need to start doing stuff and paying attention in Hawaii, so yeah.
Some, like Jordan Trinidad, were disturbed by the military parade in our nation's capital.
The administration wants to run so much on budget and budget cutting and saving things, but they want to have a $1 million parade for his birthday, military parade, for what reason? That's not budget cutting. It's hypocrisy is what it is.
Others, like Justina Spiritu, had due process on their minds.
I think today I was thinking really about due process, you know, kind of boring, but of just something we really take for granted. It's not okay to just pull people off the street indiscriminately. And I think we've already seen numerous examples. You know, I think people would argue, like, yes, there's people aren't supposed to be here without certain process, but to use that as an excuse to pull all kinds of people off the street and treat them inhumanely, that's not the rule of law that is protected by our Constitution. And I think people, reminding people that we can't take that for granted, that this is what makes America, I think, unique. I think we look at other countries and it's like, oh, that's, you see leaders doing things erratically and without being checked. And realizing that even here in America, we have to keep those kind of actions in check. I think we're really vulnerable when it's okay if the president declares some kind of national security emergency, and so our rights slowly get eroded. If we don't keep that in check, I do believe it's kind of a test. And so we have to stand here and say that we're paying attention.
More people attended the No Kings protests than past demonstrations during Trump's second term in office. The increased turnout included a number of young people. Tricia and Ian spoke with the Conversation's Maddie Bender.
I'm an immigrant. I grew up in the Philippines. I moved here about 13 years ago. Right now, it feels so good to be part of this community, fighting for the rights of my people and everyone in the community, not just over here.
And then for me, I'm from California, so I have friends that are undocumented, and it pains me to know that like they're not safe right now. So.
And both of you have on kind of rainbow. You're wearing a pride flag. Could you talk a little bit about that? It's Pride Month. What that means to you?
Yeah. So we're both proud allies. We have a lot of friends. And family members that are part of the LGBTQ community. And growing up in the Philippines, it was hard for them. They couldn't, you know, come out without, you know, harsh consequences. But now that we're here in the U.S., I thought we felt free enough for them, but no, like, I'm backing down all those rights. So it's just sad to see.
And then just, like, what do you wish people knew right now, like, from your perspective as an immigrant here in Hawaii? What do you wish they knew about you?
It's not as easy. I know people say like they just have to do it the right way. They just have to come in legally, but it's not as easy as it looks. My parents had to wait 20 years for us to get here, and it was hard, and we're very fortunate and lucky that we had the privilege to come here. And the people who wanted to just come here, they just want better lives for themselves. They had to leave their lives wherever they came from. But it doesn't mean that, you know, it doesn't mean that they're bad. We should stop demonizing them just because they want better lives for themselves.
Protesters carried signs criticizing the work of the Department of Government Efficiency, expressing fears over what they see as a descent into authoritarian rule. Too much wrong for one sign was a common refrain. Christine Crosby worries about checks and balances.
What brought you out here today?
I'm protesting Donald Trump and his authoritarian behavior and the fact that he's not respecting the balance of power in our government and trying to do things like eliminate federal programs and jobs and trying to do things like have, say, this military parade or any type of thing that's not very democratic, you know, acting more like an authoritarian dictator, doing what he wants and pardoning people like the January 6th protesters.
You know, slight showers didn't deter the crowds in Honolulu, but some took shelter inside the Capitol Rotunda, where they stumbled upon a ceremony honoring the 250th birthday of the U.S. Army and the 136th anniversary of Flag Day. A member of the Freemason-affiliated National Sojourners dressed in historical garb and read the poem A Toast to the Flag to a small audience that included military officers and politicians.
Here's to the whole of it. Stars, stripes, and the whole of it. Body and soul of it. Oh, and the roll of it, sun shining through. Hearts in accord for it. Sweared by the sword for it. Thanking the Lord for it. Red, white, and blue.
And back outside, Mele Welte said she felt spurred to attend the protest after the Trump administration sent members of the National Guard and U.S. Marines to immigration protests in Los Angeles. Welte is a former educator for Kamehameha Schools.
I felt like I had to be here, definitely had to be here, especially after what happened in Los Angeles. I think that may be the key for this crowd size, too. When you bring on the United States Marines against civilians, I think that probably, we were going to be here anyway. I'd already made signs. Sarah made signs. And I said to her, we're going to go no matter what, no matter how we feel, no matter what happens. I don't care how crowded it is, we're going to go. And then my sign, under assault, fight back, because I really do believe that the essence of the whole thing. We really are under assault. Our democracy is under assault. How can we stand by and not speak up and say something? So if there's another rally, we'll be there. We'll be as many rallies as we can get to try to say we the people are more powerful than the leader in charge who thinks he's a king or a dictator. So, yes, we had to be here.
In the conversation, C.W. Gibson spoke with Sierra Robles there with her one-year-old.
I'm half Navajo, half Mexican. All my roots come from indigenous culture, and this was our land to begin with. And you don't get to pick and choose who gets to stay here. It's pro-humanity, it always will be, and that's just the way that it should always be.
How old is your son here?
He just turned a year.
Fantastic. Is this his first protest?
This is his first protest. It's my dog's second protest. We were here on the state capitol when it came bans off our body. You know, this is my third protest, and I will always stand up for what is right and what is right for the people. You know, it's humanity over anything.
And Rita Economos, who had her two young children in tow, had this to say.
We're out here because we don't want to mortgage our children's future for short-term gains. The loss of science funding, the loss of education funding, we need science and education for our future and for our children's future and for the future of this world that we all live on and all share together.
And Economos' daughter had the final word, telling HPR she thought her cat, Rocco, would make a better leader than Donald Trump. You can find photos of the rally at our website, hawaiipublicradio.org. What are your thoughts after this past weekend? Leave us a voicemail and add to the conversation, 808-792-8217.
Support for HPR comes from Ruby Tuesday Hawaii, with locations in Moanalua and Kaneohe, offering dine-in and takeout daily and catering available for business meetings and events. RubyTuesdayHawaii.com.
Looking for cool, unique experiences and events happening across our Hawaiian Islands? Let your new HPR besties show you the way. Introducing HPR's Social Club newsletter. Every Wednesday, get the latest happenings straight to your inbox. Sign up at hawaiipublicradio.org/socialclub.
Support for HPR comes from Haleakala Ranch, with a legacy of livestock, conservation, and land stewardship since 1888, working to restore, maintain, and preserve the open vistas and natural beauty of Maui. More at haleakalaranch.com.
You know, on the conversation last week, we talked to Vasila Sirmos, the University of Hawaii Manoa's Vice President for Research and Innovation, who expressed his fear that the drastic cuts to science funding would hurt innovation in this country. An article in the June edition of Hawaii Business Magazine highlights the need to find our future. The authors are Paul Brubaker of TZ Economics and Patrick Sullivan, founder and CEO of Oceanit. We heard from them last year when they wrote an opinion piece titled Losing Our Future. This time they are challenging all of us to find it.
The first paper, I thought, made a good case for paying attention and concern. The big problem with the paper was people kept saying, so what do I do? And so we thought, we deliberately avoided trying to throw out solutions as though, here's your fix-all, just take two of these, go to bed and wake up and it'll be over. We thought, okay, let's talk about the problem. The second paper really talks about the solution in the solution space, without picking things, just to discuss the opportunity space, which is huge. From a policy framework, that's why the policy ecosystem framework, because we can do a lot, we still don't do hardly anything. And I think that's the concern, is that there's more we can do, there's a lot to choose from. The community can get together and choose, but doing nothing is not helping. So we know where that goes. And when I say nothing, I know that we've got a whole group marketing tourism, and we want to see tourism be successful. But we also see what's really going on around us, and it's not good. And the direction is a bad trend. And we think we could do better. And in this environment where the federal government is decreasing investment into, for example, climate-related research, which the University of Hawaii really doubled down on, we've got to be thinking more deeply about what to do. There still is a need for research and innovation, but maybe in a different way.
Not just science. I'm sure people in history are worried about where their grants are going to be coming from because they're studying the wrong things. They're too DEI or whatever the challenge is. So it's R&D in general that is under threat.
I've talked to a number of scientists who are concerned at this shift because science appears to be under attack. It is certainly going to be underfunded or at least not funded. The funding is going to be cut. And I know there are legal challenges that are working their way through the courts. I wonder what happens when we get past this initial year. And I hear these scientists say the collateral damage is just going to be stunning.
In my opinion, the biggest risk is to human capital. And people that get into this educational pipeline to get advanced degrees, to do basic research, and then want to go to teach at a university or get picked up at a national lab or that kind of thing, that whole supply of people is going to be interrupted, and it could take a decade to rebuild it. And all of those people, as they're moving through this process of increased education and sophisticated capability development, basically, the intellectual property and the capital that comes from that gets diminished. For example, numbers of patents, numbers of inventions. So sometimes a lot of those ideas appear to be esoteric or maybe currently in the current day, maybe not usable, but somewhere in the future, a lot of them are in fact quite usable. And so the reality is methods and materials change, and what was impossible becomes possible, and it leans heavily on this kind of research. And so with publications going to go down, it's not just publishing in an echo chamber, it's fundamental science, physics, engineering, materials, chemistry, mathematics. That is the foundation of innovation. You add a little bit of art and music and everything else around this process of imagination, you combine those two things and you have an unstoppable force. What we're doing is we're cutting the legs out from underneath part of that engine.
And we're in a situation now where there are folks who are worried about the brain drain. A lot of institutional memory, a lot of knowledge is being forced out. And what's to stop those folks from moving to another country where they're actively being courted? Because it appears that we aren't putting that same type of, I don't know, it's appreciation, the value, I guess, in what they do.
Yeah, I grew up in an academic household where the majority of my dad's graduate students were from abroad. They weren't from the United States. There were some, but I can tell you, just as a kid growing up in that community, that in that ohana, 50 PhD students from everywhere, from East Asia to East Africa and beyond, Latin America, that the community that was built within that ohana radiated outward worldwide, literally, and became a network that over the arc of my dad's life and then for us kids growing up became a community in and of itself, which of course then was integrated and networked in other communities. We're talking about a world in the 60s where people were just coming to grips with moving beyond the legacy of the Second World War and into this, what we would now call sort of the globalist, the liberal global order, so to speak, which is rapidly being dismantled. And Hawaii was able to participate on equal footing long before the internet connected us and overcame the geographic isolation that Hawaii has had to transcend in the past with transportation modes and whatnot. These communities, these intellectual communities, had been built and formed, and Hawaii was a magnet. If anything, the drain was coming the other way. It was coming to Hawaii and to the United States, and academic institutions in which all of us went to school prospered because of the rigor and competition, the jockeying academically to do well, to perform at a standard in which the qualities of our performances, let's say as American students, were being disciplined by the smartest people from around the world who had joined in to participate in American academic institutions, and then, of course, later in private, corporate, philanthropic, nonprofit research organizations, the whole spectrum. Like, that's where we lead. That's where America leads. And it's being dismantled very rapidly. And in addition to the supply chain problem that Patrick alluded to, right, there's a process here going on of intergenerational transfer of knowledge and human capital formation. There's a reputation effect. There's a vulnerability. It took us 80 years in the post-war period to build that reputation. And it's taken these clowns in D.C. about 4 months to dismantle it and completely undermine the credibility of America's commitment to a stable global trading order or to a commitment to academic freedom and individual liberties and freedom of speech and the rule of law. It's all being dismantled really rapidly. That's not what Patrick and I were writing about over the last year. And we finally got to the end of whatever it was we'd written, and it turned out worse. We were just concerned about the problems in Hawaii of being able to capture the potential that's slipping through our fingers, maybe out of a failure to recognize what's possible. But now we have this, like, exogenous, adverse, odious, dark force that's plunging us all downward.
Patrick, what's your hope? Maybe the climate will accelerate people's decisions about what we need to do and how fast we need to do it. I guess the sense of urgency.
That's a good question. I think the response will take probably more pain and more, unfortunately, disruption to the current ecosystem. It's not that it can't get tuned up or doesn't need to be tuned up. It does from time to time. That's healthy. But the system we've built, if you really kind of step way back, the land grant program created and signed into law by Abraham Lincoln was the U.S.'s response to the competitive world with the Industrial Revolution that bet on creating human capital to compete and build the economy. That's how we build the economy in the U.S. today. It's taken a long time to do that, setting up all these universities. And they all were to include programs in what today we call STEM education, a big push in agricultural sciences, because for the U.S. to compete and create jobs and to build a vibrant economy, it needed people. Without people, you don't really have a vibrant economy. AI doesn't change that. And so we've taken that infrastructure, which is the envy of the world, and we've been cutting it back and beating it back, and that human capital takes time to replace. And so it could easily be, again, a decade. What we see is that, for example, we'll be hiring a lot of these young graduates, if we can, that can't go to universities or national labs, but maybe real bright, talented people, because those opportunities have been shut off. They're going to find a place to go. And you're right about the comment of the other parts of the world attracting American talent. That's the smart move for them, to build that kind of talent and to try to keep it. That's maybe an opportunity for a place like Hawaii. It's a little counterintuitive because the university's getting hammered. They're losing a lot of programs. But if the state took almost a contrarian view and looked at trying to create opportunities to bring talent to Hawaii to help build the future when the storm passes, it's hard to know how many years that will be, but there's going to be a need for innovation, a need for new ideas. A part of the American competitiveness in national security is a function of innovation. Not just thinking of it, but building it and delivering at scale. Building that here might be an opportunity for a place like Hawaii, because a lot of the centers around the country are getting decimated.
That was Paul Brubaker and Patrick Sullivan, authors of a position paper published this month in Hawaii Business Magazine. It's a challenge to power brokers and policymakers in this town to make meaningful change to help chart our future. We'll hear more from them after a break. Tune to The Conversation here on Hawaii Public Radio. I'm Catherine Cruz. We return to our conversation with TZ Economics' Paul Brubaker and Oceanit's Patrick Sullivan about a call to find our future with a sense of urgency.
I think Patrick makes a good point that in the near term, it looks like we're going to have to fight for the right to research. The funding being taken away is a real challenge for institutions that have been built around a steady stream of funding. And to be fair, it's not just in the public sector, but in the private sector where research and development in a good year is maybe 3 or 4% of GDP. That's really important. The upheaval for young people that are pursuing advanced educations and moving out into the, a lot of people do postdoc and fellowships and that kind of thing on their way to their final landing place, whether it's in academia or in the private sector or in the nonprofit arena. And that's going to be all twisted and contorted as we move through whatever happens. We're going to have to fight to rebuild, to preserve what we can. We're going to have to rely on the courts, unfortunately, since they seem to be the least efficient way of resolving these issues where unconstitutional and illegal executive actions are being taken, but there's no enforcement mechanism other than legal process. But at the other end of, to the extent we were able to restore the institutional structure or not, we should still be thinking about alternative ways of making this something that Hawaii can do and, as Patrick said, scale. For one reason, we can scale virtually now in a way that the way you can collaborate now is like it's never been, and at some point we're going to be doing it in the metaverse, maybe. So that barrier, the ability to scale, has been dismantled in large part for a small, remote place like Hawaii. Then to flip that on its head, a big part of what Hawaii has succeeded in history, recent history especially, is grounded in the natural resource cultural endowment that is distinct, even idiosyncratic, not a lot of places, even among tropical islands, have the kind of combination that Hawaii's had. And so a lot of what happens at UH, and for example, a land-grant college, to the point Patrick made about Abraham Lincoln having the wisdom to do this 150 years ago, 160 years ago, set up a system where research at that time and focus on agriculture could be propagated outward into the community through extension. There's the basic idea of extending the scope of findings and of discoveries and of applications to the to people out in the actual, you know, business world or in jurisdictions that were looking for a better way to organize their communities. Or but that opportunity for Hawaii to take advantage of the connectivity and yet continue to realize the unique benefits associated with our endowment through formation of the human capital rooted in the comparative advantages that arise from that continues to be an opportunity irrespective of what adversities we face either in the national political landscape or from our own sort of misguided, making the wrong bets or whatever Hawaii has been doing to itself over the last couple decades.
So it's not really saying, oh, we need to do this. We need to put all eggs in AI or whatever. You're saying let's create a climate where we can foster our creativity.
A climate that supports different opinions, perspectives. I think a new idea gets killed quickly here because everybody thinks the world is static, when in fact the world isn't static, never has been. And I think that's what's going on right now. It's kind of a wake-up call that things aren't the same and they're going to keep changing. But it doesn't mean there aren't opportunities. And Hawaii is a very unique place to innovate. Innovation comes from differences. A great environment, great culture, and people with different perspectives and ideas and backgrounds coming together. That's where real innovation happens. The market can be global because we're really connected back to the scalability thing. So you're connected through the internet, but that connects supply chains and manufacturing and distribution and everything else so that we're not geographically constrained unless we choose to be that way. But we can be a great place to live, to create things, and to scale what makes sense to scale here. For example, we're working on an interesting project to produce a new fabric called Caretex, which is made from chicken feathers. It looks like a fine fabric. Now, we're meeting next week with the largest chicken harvesting company in the world, in the United States, maybe in the world, which happens to be in Arkansas. We're okay with that because you want to be close to where the chickens are if you're going to be making a global fabric that is based on a waste product that mostly goes, you know, nowhere. But the ideas and the creation of those things were all done right here. But if we're going to do a global supply of this material, then we need to start thinking about it globally. And geography isn't our constraint. But what we can do in a place like Hawaii is make it easier for people to have these different ideas. And there's a lot of ways to support them.
We just recently talked to Nobel Prize winner Jennifer Doudna, who's from Hilo, Hilo High School. And she was talking about the applications for gene editing and how they're looking at it to mess around with the gut biome of cows so they can reduce the methane gas that they emit. But it's that kind of thing where, yeah, gene editing, CRISPR, came out of Hilo, the humble roots, and yet the applications for, let's say, agriculture could really take off.
CRISPR was immediately adopted within years of Professor Doudna and her co-authors, Nobel Prize-winning creation, by students of my dad who had gone into the maize corn genetics industry here in Hawaii. And I remember visiting them on Kauai, and they said, "Well, we just go out in the field and we can scan the leaves of the corn plants to make sure that the genetic structure we're looking for is." They had scanners where they could scan every seed. It was just crazy what they were talking about. My dad told me the story when he was at Cornell in the late 1940s, early 1950s, working on his PhD in genetics. A woman named Barbara McClintock came to visit to make a presentation, another great geneticist, biochemist like Jennifer Doudna. And she had come to this theory on her own about jumping genes. And I guess she was just utterly ridiculed in this seminar at Cornell. And my dad felt really bad for her. He was embarrassed to be in the audience watching this poor young woman just getting hammered. And apparently she drifted off into obscurity after that. Now those are known as transpositional genes, and everybody knows that genes jump. And my point is that there are a lot of people, maybe it's where they come from. Hilo High School, are you serious? Think about the fact that a Nobel Prize-winning biochemist could come from Hilo High School and end up creating CRISPR-Cas9 gene editing technology, a technology that briefly was banned on the Big Island, Maui, and Kauai by popular vote. But transgenic modification literally was banned by popular vote on all those neighbor island counties, including the one where Jennifer Doudna grew up, before the courts said, you can't do that. And once again, thank goodness for the courts to be able to step in and remind us of what the boundaries are on limiting the fruits of intellectual exploration and discovery.
Patrick, what do you think is the big takeaway for you? What's the call that you're trying to make? When we had the Great Recession, right, I remember we pulled together people from across the community, right, economists, folks from different industries, trying to figure out how do we pull ourselves out of this situation? So what's your takeaway?
I think we have to realize that we have an abundance of opportunity to build the future, and the choice is ours. And so we have to stop saying, no, we can't do that. No, you shouldn't do that. No, you shouldn't try that. No, we can't talk about it. No, when in fact, we should be talking about, yes, let's solve that problem. Yes, let's fix the beaches. Yes, let's build more resilient agriculture. Yes, let's supply the world with more resilient food. Yes, we can do a lot of things by working together and building on each other.
That was Patrick Sullivan and Paul Brubaker discussing their position paper, which is published in this month's edition of Hawaii Business Magazine. Look for links on our website later today. And full disclosure, I took part in a project with Sullivan around his book, Intellectual Anarchy, The Art of Disruptive Innovation.
The so-called One Big Beautiful Bill is making huge changes to healthcare, not necessarily to increase healthcare access, but as cost savings and cost cutting to pay for other things.
Most of the items in the bill that increase spending are related to like taxes and immigration, and healthcare is kind of being used as a way to pay for those things.
That's on the next On Point.
Beginning this afternoon at 2, following the world.
Support for The Conversation comes from the HPR Local Talk Show Fund, which helps Hawaii Public Radio sustain and grow its locally produced talk shows. Mahalo to contributors PCAT, Pacific Center for Advanced Technology Training, and the Rice Partnership.
You know, it's been decades since France ended its testing of nuclear weapons in the Pacific, but the debate over compensation for those impacted by the fallout still continues today. Here to talk about that is HPR's Cassie Ordonio. Good morning.
Good morning, Catherine. Thanks for having me.
Yes. Yeah, so what's the latest chatter?
So there are Tahitians in the diaspora who are Ma'ohi who has been raising awareness about the compensation issues of Tahitians who are impacted by the nuclear history of France on French Polynesia, and that includes two atolls that they tested on. So France conducted 193 nuclear tests from 1966 to 1996 at Mururoa and Fungatalfa atolls. That also includes 41 atmospheric tests. Those are the above ground tests that exposed people working in those areas until the mid-1970s. And France was one of the last countries to actually stop nuclear testing in 1996. The U.S., when they conducted 67 nuclear tests on the Marshall Islands, they stopped before France. So I spoke with Vehia Wheeler, who is from Hawaii, and she was one of the five environmental activists from Ma'ohi Nui or French Polynesia who attended the third United Nations meeting on prohibiting nuclear weapons in March.
It's important for us to go to these types of meetings because we learn more about what are the international mechanisms that are working towards nuclear justice. The issue with our case and also with Marshall Islands is that that treaty has been signed by many countries in the world and basically all countries in the Pacific, all independent countries in the Pacific, but that treaty has not been signed by France, which is our colonial colonizer here in Tahiti, Ma'ohi Nui. And that means like us as a territory or colony of France, we don't have the right to sign that treaty. Only member states, nation states, countries have the right to sign that treaty. And it's the same with Marshall Islands. They can sign treaties, but they are closely affiliated with the United States as well. So I'm not sure if that influences their participation in the treaty, but they also have not signed. But Kiribati, who is a country and who has also experienced nuclear testing, did sign the treaty, and they have actually been very active in the articles and the details of this treaty. And this treaty is really important because part of the treaty focuses on prohibiting the use of nuclear weapons, development of them because of how dangerous the consequences are. And then one part of the treaty also addresses the health impacts and environmental remediation that is needed for communities that have already experienced nuclear explosion from nuclear weapons.
So in 2010, France created a nuclear compensation plan for victims in French Polynesia and Algeria after pressure from veterans and civilians. But during that time, only 97% of complaints between 2010 and 2017 were denied. And that's because of a strict criteria for victims proving a direct link to their illnesses, like cancers, and connecting it to the radiation exposure from the nuclear test. And these are like actually reviewed by a committee that France created during that time. And so in 2021 or 2017, actually, they revamped the criteria, but there are still kind of strict components that led to about half of the complaints that were approved when that criteria was changed. Vahia Wheeler talks about the compensation and how hard it is for people to still get the money.
Well, it's not a wait list specifically. So what happens is you apply to get compensation. Like in 2010, that's when people were able to apply to receive compensation from France. And compensation is only monetary. So that's just in and of itself is a huge problem, because money does not necessarily cure this problem, right? It doesn't, it helps because it costs money for people to get healthcare. It costs money for funerals, it costs money for a lot of things, to travel, for healthcare, but already the compensation that they are offering is very limited. And then if you don't receive compensation, you're not on a wait list. You're just done. It's done. Then you have to reapply.
So the French consulate did send me a written statement that France has demonstrated a quote-unquote unmatched transparency regarding the nuclear test that was conducted. But Tahitians in the diaspora feel that it's not as transparent and more could be done. Wheeler said that she hopes that there will be more honest education in France about the nuclear history, more funding for medical care, like cancer treatment facilities in Tahiti, and even more environmental studies in the islands. So that's something that they're pushing for. And talking to Teatu Here Tsitsi Gerlach, she actually has a history of cancers and reproductive health issues that run in her family. And although it's unclear if there's a direct link between the nuclear history that France has done, her family feels that it's likely due to that.
Yeah, but that's the tough nut to crack, is to make a correlation, right? That's the challenge.
Exactly.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you so much, Cassie.
Thanks for having me.
We've been talking to HPR's Cassie Ordonio about nuclear justice for Tahiti. You can hear her story online at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Today on The Daily, during a dark and tumultuous weekend, two shootings in Minnesota left one lawmaker dead and another seriously injured. While overseas, Israel and Iran traded devastating strikes back and forth in what some fear is a new phase of violence in the Middle East. I'm Rachel Abrams. That's Today on The Daily from The New York Times.
Beginning this evening at 6:30.
L&L. It's a success story that started with a plate lunch in Waimanalo, and decades later, the drive-in has been parlayed into 235 stores across America. The success story is Eddie Flores Jr.'s family story. It's a Filipino-Chinese immigrant story tied to a tough work ethic, an entrepreneurial spirit, and if you know Eddie, a sense of humor.
Our family came over from Hong Kong. My mom is Chinese, my father is Filipino, and it was very difficult for them, because they both have no skill, sixth grade education. And my mom worked as a dishwasher. And when I graduated from college, I was able to work at a bank, and subsequently I started a real estate company. And I made money within 2-3 years. And I found this little restaurant called L&L Drive-In in 1976. And I told my mom, I'm going to buy you a restaurant. And I bought it and gave it to her as a gift.
Wow. And then it started from there?
Not really. I wasn't in restaurant business. When you have a college degree and you're very proud to be a grad, you don't go into restaurant business. It's very hard. And my mom stayed there for about 3 years. Actually, when I bought the restaurant, I have my partner, my good friend, his name is Johnson Cam. He came in and he took over half the restaurant. My mom had the other half. So he works at night and my mom worked daytime. And after about 2-3 years, my mom was no longer interested in the restaurant business. So I sold everything to Mr. Johnson Camp. So he did all the work initially.
And then this idea of franchising.
It's funny. I want to tell you, not too many people know Johnson Camp. He's a very generous man. And he helped a lot of his Chinese immigrant friends. And what he did was he saw his restaurant very successful, L&L very successful. So they said, can you teach me? And he taught them how to do it. In fact, help them sign the leases and so on as a good person. So after a while, there were about 4 or 5 that I can remember after about 10, 15 years. And one day we were traveling in Maui and I asked him, hey, Johnson, why did you let people use your name and teach them how to do it without charging a fee? I think you should franchise it. And that's not the Chinese way of doing business. You have to charge. And he agreed with me. He asked me if I want to come back to help him. That's when I came back and I said, okay, I'll help you.
Yeah, just this concept and this notion that you could really grow it in this way.
No one ever think that we can grow it. In fact, when I met with a couple of distributors, I told them, hey, within 10 years, I would opening about 20, 30 restaurants. And that gentleman never say a word. And then he remarked to me that I have heard that stories many times. And I really feel offended. But we were very fortunate. And it's really a good partnership between me and my partner, Johnson Cam, because he doesn't run the business at all. I have 100% control of the business. And basically what he did was he would find a location, a restaurant, turn it into an L. And when he finds some of the cooks that's very reliable, hardworking, and he would sell it to them. And that's how we expanded initially. We didn't really open a franchise because franchise is very difficult.
So these folks knew what they were doing. They were in the kitchen. They were doing the work.
Believe me, when you work in a kitchen for 16 hours, you work 60 hours minimum. Believe me, restaurant is not easy. All the cooks, they all work 60 hours. Not even L&L, any restaurant, they work long hours. You know, when a guy worked hard enough, especially what Johnson did was, if you notice that most of the L&L in Hawaii are Chinese speaking. They're the immigrants. They can't speak English, but they work very hard. And Johnson rewarded them by giving them the restaurant.
Yeah,
and sell it to them. They have no money. They have no financial statement. So we guarantee and help them. And eventually, I think we opened almost like 40, 50 using that method.
And gosh, you decided to write a book about this, franchising the American dream, of the story behind L&L.
Oh, yeah. Let me tell you, I may have mentioned to you earlier, there is no other company in Hawaii that franchised successfully for a long time like us. We've been around for almost 40 years now, and franchising is still continuing to grow. And we actually dominated the market in the mainland because back in the old days, I remember when I flew up to the mainland, you don't see any Hawaiian barbecue plate lunches. In fact, the word Hawaiian barbecue is non-existent. I coined a word I call Hawaiian barbecue. I figured Hawaiian is good. It's a draw. A barbecue, that's for the American. And we hang on with the name L&L, so we call it L&L Hawaiian barbecue. And today we have 235 locations spread out in 14 states. 14 states. We just opened 2 in New Mexico and the third and 3 in New York City just the last 2-3 months.
And so are you using that same formula of
finding
the cooks?
It's changed. It changed. In Hawaii, it's a different market. When we went to the mainland, I can't find any immigrants. We don't know any people up there. So it's a word of mouth. We haven't really gone up there to market the name, but people would come to us. To tell you, franchising is not easy. That's why not too many companies in Hawaii have ever done that successfully. To start a franchise, a company, you need an attorney to draft up the paper. It may cost about $100,000. And then you need to have audited financial statement. You got to have a track history. In every state, you have to file for franchising too. It's not easy. So we opened in 14 states. We actually have to do it in 14 states, and it costs a lot of money to hire an attorney in the mainland. They charge anywhere from $500 to $1,000 per hour. It's not cheap. And you have to give them the support too. Back in the old days, we didn't give them any support. We just say, hey, how are you doing? Just work hard. But nowadays, we have to do newsletter. We have to do marketing. We have to do purchasing. We have to do all kind of stuff. So if you don't have more than 50 to 100 restaurants as franchisee, you're not going to make money because you need a staff to support it.
So why did you decide to put this down on paper?
I'm more than happy to share. I like to talk story. I always like to talk to people. As you notice, I wrote two books, but those two books are really joke books. And the reason I wrote books is because when I was a student at University of Hawaii, I got an F in English. And I said, hey, I'm going to show my professor wrongs. So this is actually the fifth book that I'm writing. I actually wrote two books on how to sell restaurants and bars about 40 years ago.
Wow.
And then I started another book on China history and culture, and then another one on cookbook. And I tell people, I don't cook, but I'm writing a cookbook. It's not that difficult. But on this book on franchising, the American dream is actually, I wrote it because I'm semi-retired. And one day I told my daughter, who's in charge now, she's my boss, Alicia Flores, honey, give me a raise, okay, please? and my daughter, so she's running the show. I think two summers ago, I sat down and I said, hey, let me write about franchising. So I spent 3 months just nonstop, just wrote the book. It's not that difficult. If you just sit down and write it, and my English is not that good, but you can always hire an editor to edit your English.
I just think of all the restaurants that we have come to love here in Hawaii, and sadly some have closed. Some are victims of the pandemic or just the economy. But just wonderful family stories, right? From Bale, and he has his sons are running the business. But you just stop and consider all the wonderful memories that are tied into our eateries.
It is true. If you want to know the history of L&L, I mean, back in 1952, it was actually owned by a Korean family called Lee and Lee Dairy in Waimanalo. And eventually, he turned into a fast food takeout. And in 1969, I think, he sold it and changed hands several times. In 1976, we bought it.
And the rest is history. That is the nugget behind L&L Hawaiian Barbecue and the successful small business story that is Eddie Flores Jr. The Honolulu Businessman will be on hand for a book signing and talk story time on Saturday, June 21st at 2 p.m. at Barnes & Noble Ala Moana.
Shoe on the cup, beef stew, heavy on the extra salad, two scoop rice on the hamburger bun, hot dog, kimchi, chili pepper water, akuli, aku, mahi, mahi sandwich, top it all up with the kikuman shoyu, he on the tomi no ho itau, itu pute momonia. Magapua, magapua, pepe, au, mokole.
Well, that's it for us today. Tomorrow, we'll hear about the Kua'aina Burger success story. It started 5 decades ago with one store on Oahu's North Shore, and now there are more than 30 in Japan. Got feedback? Call or talk back line 808-792-8217. You can find the conversation on our website or on Spotify or Apple. I'm Catherine Cruz. We'll be back tomorrow with more of the conversation.